In the salutation in verse 4, Lama Tsongkhapa refers to Atisha as a holder of a treasure of instructions. This is a reference to Atisha's lamp for the path to enlightenment, although the lamp is quite a short text. It is extremely comprehensive in its subject matter and contains very profound instructions. According to traditional explanations, it is regarded as the instructions of Maitreya's ornament of clear realization in distilled form. The main source for Atisha's lamp is a section in the second chapter of Maitreya's text. In stating the sequence of the path and practices, Maitreya talks about cultivating faith in the three jewels and the altruistic intention. He goes on to describe taking the bodhicitta vow and engaging in the path by embodying the ideals of the bodhisattva through the practice of the six perfections, and then explains how to engage in the cultivation of wisdom where there is a union between calm abiding, shamatha, and penetrative insight, vipassana. This is how the Tibetan tradition understands the source of inspiration for Atisha's text. Lines of Experience, verse 5. Respectfully, I prostrate before my spiritual masters. You are the eyes allowing us to behold all the infinite scriptural pronouncements, the best ford for those of good fortune to cross to liberation. You make everything clear through your skillful deeds, which are moved by intense loving concern. In this verse, Lama Tsongkhapa makes salutations to the lineage masters responsible for maintaining and transmitting the practices of the Lamrim teachings. There is a saying attributed to one of the Kadampa masters, "Whenever I teach Lamrim, the great scriptures shudder and say, 'This old monk is extracting our heart.'" Lama Tsongkhapa died about 600 years ago. Of his three main Lamrim texts, the Great Exposition of the Stages of the Path is the most important, but in all three, he presents the elements of the path to enlightenment, the profound view of emptiness and the vast practice of skillful means, in varying degrees of detail, introducing the essential points of these practices in a systematic way, such that even today we can study, contemplate, and implement them in our meditation practice. Regardless of whether the term Lamrim, or stages of the path, is used, all traditions of Tibetan Buddhism, the old translation school, the Nyingma, and the new translation schools, such as the Sakya and Kangyu, have equivalent teachings that emphasize the foundational practices. Furthermore, the teachings of all four schools of Tibetan Buddhism can be validated by tracing their origins back to the writings of authentic Indian masters. In the tradition of the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism, for example, there is the genre of teachings known as terma, or texts of revelation, and another known as kama, or scriptural teachings. However, even teachings of the revealed tradition must be grounded in those of the scriptural category. In fact, the Nyingma tradition states that the teachings of the revealed texts should be regarded as more for simply channeling one's focus and sharpening one's practice. The Greatness of the Lamrim Teachings. Lines of Experience, verses 6 and 7. The stages of the path to enlightenment have been transmitted intact by those who have followed in order both from Nagarjuna and Asanga, those crowning jewels of all erudite masters of our southern continent, and the banner of whose fame stands out above the masses. As following these stages can fulfill every desirable aim of all nine kinds of being, they are a power-granting king of precious instruction. Because they collect the streams of thousands of excellent classics, they are indeed an ocean of illustrious, correct explanation. These teachings make it easy to understand how there is nothing contradictory in all the Buddha's teachings and make every scriptural pronouncement without exception dawn on your mind as a personal instruction. They make it easy to discover what the Buddha intended and protect you as well from the abyss of the great error. Because of these four benefits, what discriminating person among the erudite masters of India and Tibet would not have his or her mind be completely enraptured by these stages of the path arranged according to the three levels of motivation, the supreme instruction to which many fortunate ones have devoted themselves? These two verses present the greatness and quality of the Lamrim teachings. Verse 6 explains the nature and lineage of the teaching, while verse 7 explains its benefits. 1. There is nothing contradictory. One of the greatnesses of the Lamrim tradition is that these teachings enable you to recognize that there are no contradictions in any of the teachings of the Buddha. If you look at the diversity of teachings in the Mahayana scriptures, you will find that certain practices are sometimes prohibited, while at other times they are encouraged. If you understand the significance of this diversity, however, you will understand that these teachings are contingent upon the different levels or capacities of the practitioners to whom they have been given. Atisha organized the entire teaching of the Buddha into the three capacities or scopes, according to the abilities of different practitioners. Therefore, practices that are restricted for some are encouraged for others. If you don't bear this in mind, you may develop misconceptions, which occasionally happened in Tibet. At one time in Tibet, there were practitioners who denigrated and rejected Vajrayana because of their tremendous devotion to and focus on the Vinaya, while others, because of their great admiration and enthusiasm for Vajrayana, neglected the practice of ethical discipline. If you understand Atisha's explanation of how the teachings of the Buddha are organized according to practitioners' different levels of mind, you will protect yourself from such grave errors. 2. Every scriptural pronouncement without exception will dawn on your mind as a personal instruction. The second greatness of the Lamrim is that all the teachings of the Buddha will dawn on your mind as a personal instruction. If your understanding of the Buddha's teachings is limited, there is the danger that you will discriminate between the scriptures, regarding some as relevant to your practice and others as relevant only for academic study. If your understanding is more profound, however, you will realize that the way of the intelligent is to have an overview of the entire Buddhist path. This allows you to appreciate which teachings are relevant at a particular stage in your practice and which are not, while understanding that all the scriptures are instructions that will ultimately be relevant to your own personal practice at some point. 3. Easy to discover what the Buddha intended. The third greatness is that you will easily realize the Buddha's ultimate intention, that all the Buddha's teachings can actually converge in your practice. This will allow you to fulfill your spiritual aspirations, whatever they are: higher rebirth, liberation from cyclic existence, Sanskrit samsara, or complete enlightenment. 4. Protect you from the abyss of the great error. The fourth greatness of the Lamrim is that it protects you from the abyss of the great error, the great mistake of abandoning the Dharma. If you realize that all the Buddha's scriptures and teachings are relevant to your own personal practice, there is no room for discarding some and adopting others, because you realize that actually you need them all. Therefore, you will not abandon any of the Buddha's teachings. This point also relates to the issue of sectarianism. Practitioners sometimes harbor sectarian sentiments because of differences between the four Tibetan Buddhist traditions. If you can understand the unique features of each tradition, their methods of approach, teaching, and various types of practices, you will appreciate the value and importance of this variety. It is, in fact, possible for a single individual to integrate all these diverse teachings into his or her personal practice. As the Kadampa masters used to say, one should know how to uphold the entire teaching of the Buddha, like lifting a square piece of cloth all at once. Some Mahayana practitioners make distinctions between the lesser vehicle and the great vehicle, tending to dismiss the lesser vehicle teachings, particularly the Theravada. One of the consequences of this is that Theravadins then begin to question the authenticity of the Mahayana tradition. In fact, however, the Pali tradition, from which the Theravada teachings arose, should be regarded as the source of the Mahayana as well, particularly the teachings on the Four Noble Truths and the 37 aspects of the Path to Enlightenment. These are really the foundation and cornerstone of Buddhist practice. To these, you add the practices of the Six Perfections and so forth in the manner of refining certain aspects of these foundational practices. And finally, you add the practice of Vajrayana Buddhism. Therefore, even though you can add to it from the Bodhisattva and Vajrayana teachings, the Pali Canon is really a complete set of teachings in itself. Without the foundational teachings of the lesser vehicle, the Paramitayana and Vajrayana teachings are incomplete because they lack a basis. Question and answer period. Question. If there is a natural nirvana and a luminous, pure, fundamental nature, then what originally leads us to deviate from the pure luminosity for us to suffer from karma, defilements, obscurations, and afflictions? How come we do not retain the state of pure, luminous, natural nirvana through the cycle of births and rebirths? His Holiness, when Buddhism speaks of the luminous and fundamentally pure nature of mind or consciousness, what is being suggested is that it is possible for the defilements to be removed from the basic mind, not that there is some kind of original pure state that later became polluted by defilements. In fact, just as the continuum of our consciousness is without beginning, our delusions are also without beginning. As long as the continuum of consciousness has existed, so too has there been the continuum of delusion, the perception of inherent existence. The seeds of delusion have always been there together with the continuity of consciousness. Therefore, Buddhist texts sometimes mention innate or fundamental ignorance, which is spontaneous and simultaneous with the continuum of the individual. Only through the application of antidotes and the practice of meditation can these delusions be cleansed from the basic mind. This is what is meant by natural purity. If you examine the nature of your own mind, you will realize that the pollutants, such as afflictive emotions and thoughts rooted in a distorted way of relating to the world, are actually unstable. No matter how powerful an affliction, when you cultivate the antidote of true insight into the nature of reality, it will vanish because of the power of the antidote, which undermines its continuity. However, there is nothing that can undermine the basic mind itself, nothing that can actually interrupt the continuity of consciousness. The existence of the world of subjective experience and consciousness is a natural fact. There is consciousness. There is mind. There is no force that can bring about a cessation of your mental continuum. We can see parallels to this in the material world. According to Buddhism, the ultimate constituents of the macroscopic world of physical reality are what we call space particles, which constitute the subtlest level of physical reality. It is on the basis of the continuum of these subtle particles that the evolution of the cosmos is explained. The universe evolves out of this subtlest level of physical reality, remains for a certain period of time, then comes to an end and dissolves. The whole process of evolution and dissolution arises from this subtlest level of physical reality. Here, we are talking about a perceptible and tangible world of physical reality that we can directly experience. Of course, in this world of everyday concrete reality, there will be forces that undermine its existence. The subtle level of physical reality, however, is regarded as something that is continuous, without beginning or end. From the Buddhist point of view, there is nothing that can bring an end to the actual continuum of the subtle level of reality. Similarly, there are various manifestations of consciousness. These include the grosser levels of thought, emotion, and sensory experience, whose existence is contingent upon a certain physical reality, such as environment and time. But the basic continuum of consciousness from which these grosser levels of mind arise has neither beginning nor end. The continuum of the basic mind remains, and nothing can terminate it. If defilements had a beginning, the question would arise, where did they come from? In the same way, Buddhism does not posit a beginning to consciousness itself, because to do so raises more questions about what led to its creation. As to the question why there is no beginning of consciousness, one can argue for this on the basis of its ever-present continuum. The real argument, however, stems from a process of elimination, because if we posit a beginning of consciousness, what kind of beginning could it be, and what could have caused it? Arguing for a beginning of consciousness undermines the fundamental Buddhist belief in the law of causality. In some Buddhist texts, however, we find references to the Buddha Samantabhadra, the ever-good and ever-pure primordial Buddha. But here we have to understand the concept of primordiality in relation to individual contexts. In this understanding, the fundamental innate mind of clear light is seen as the original source of the macroscopic world of our experience. When the Vajrayana literature describes this evolution process, for example, it speaks of a reverse cycle and a forward cycle. In both cases, the world of diverse consciousness and mental activity arises from a subtler level of clear light, which then goes through what is known as the three stages of appearance. Through this process, there is an understanding that everything arises from this basic nature of clear light mind and is then dissolved into it. So again, our understanding is that this originality is in the context of individual instances, not some kind of universal beginning. Question. Your Holiness, you spoke of monasteries like Vikramashila, where there was a strict code of ethics and where even highly realized masters could be expelled for breaking a vow. Today, certain Rinpoches and high-level masters have been involved in different types of scandals. How come the code of ethics is different today? His Holiness, one thing that needs to be clearly understood is that the individuals to whom you refer are no longer in the monastic order. People who have broken their vows, particularly one of the four cardinal rules, falsely proclaiming spiritual realizations, committing murder, stealing, and engaging in sexual intercourse, will automatically be expelled from the monastery. They will be expelled even if there are strong grounds for suspicion that they have broken their vows. This applies today as much as it did in the past. However, some of those who have broken their vows still find very skillful and devious means of retaining some kind of dignity and stature. I always remind monks and nuns, therefore, that the moment they have transgressed their Vinaya vows, they should no longer wear their monastic robes. This applies equally to members of all four schools of Tibetan Buddhism, Nyingma, Sakya, Kagyu, and Gelug. Within the Tibetan tradition, however, there are two institutions of practitioners, the monastic institution of practitioners with monastic vows, and the institution of lay practitioners, who wear different colored robes, don't shave their heads, and have taken only lay precepts or pratimoksha vows.